outdoor explorer. I'm Charles Wolfhorst. Fly fishing is not the easiest way to catch a fish, by a long shot. And most fly fishermen let the fish go after they catch it anyway. Does that make any sense? I have my doubts, but after talking to my guest today, I'm starting to get it. Once you get good at something, taking it to the next level of expertise is a natural progression, at least when you're involved in a sport you love and believe in. You start wanting to learn the intricacies, make your own gear, and accomplish the most challenging feats. Few endeavors give as many opportunities for that journey to greater challenges than fly fishing. And later in the show, we're going to be hearing from a guy here in Anchorage, Chris Carlin, who builds fly rods as his occupation. I didn't even know this was a thing, but he makes bamboo fly rods. But first, we're going to talk sort of about the sport in general and what makes it special. I mean, from the point of view of an Alaskan who's used to just going and catching reds in a net, fly rods, fly fishing is sort of the opposite end of the spectrum. And Mark Huber knows all about that. He is an instructor. He's involved with Alaska Fly Fishers. He's involved with the International Federation of Fly Fishers, and he teaches people to fish. And it sounds like this is really your passion, is fly fishing.
It is. Yeah.
Well, I mean, tell me what makes it so, what makes it special? I mean, what makes it just, I guess that's a big question, but for those of us who are used to spin casting or, you know, other sort of Alaskan meat fishing, you know, it seems a little bit odd that you would make it more difficult for yourself, right?
It is, and anybody who's caught a fish on a rod and reel knows that it's somewhat of a special event and something that we enjoy doing and enjoy being out in the environment.
That thrill, yeah.
And the thrill of, you know, the bend in the rod and pulling the line out and whatnot. And then just the beauty of the fish themselves, when they're absolutely gorgeous creatures.
Yeah.
And then you take that, and as you get into the sport, at least for me, it became, you know, catching a fish with a worm wasn't any kind of a challenge, or catching a fish with a spinner or with hardware wasn't as much of a challenge. So you just keep trying to push the limits and challenging yourself. And ultimately, the most challenging part of it is that with a fly rod, with a piece of thread and feathers tied onto a hook, making a presentation to a fish.
Mm-hmm. And you're really going from nothing in a way. Instead of going to the sporting goods store and buying a lure that's been manufactured and tying it onto a piece of monofilament and stuff, you're making your own, and you're sort of, in that way, it's more sporting and it's more connecting you to the quarry in a way.
You certainly can. I mean, you had John who makes his, or you'll have him on following the program, who makes his own fly rods.
Yeah.
We have folks who make their own flies. You can actually make your own fly line if you tend to get that much involved in it.
Uh-huh.
And there certainly is a certain degree of skill and competency in terms of casting that fly line and making a good presentation to a fish.
Yeah. So, I mean, basically any kid can cast a spinning rod, I mean, with 5 minutes of instruction to some degree. But just getting your fly out onto the water takes quite a bit of work, and getting good at it takes a long time, right, with a fly rod.
I wouldn't say it takes a lot of work. It does take some finesse, and it takes understanding that instead
figuring
of having—
Figuring out how to do it, I guess, takes
figuring
work.
Figuring out how to do it,
yeah.
Right. And that's as much as anything else. Mm-hmm. And once, you know, myself or somebody else explains kind of how the fly rod works and how the line works and how the system all goes out, then getting somebody to actually do that is fairly, you know, easy process. I can have somebody casting a fly line in the course of 45 minutes or an hour.
Really? Okay. Well, let's explain for those who really don't know anything about it, which would be me, how it works exactly. I mean, what's the sort of the physics or the process or how you make it go? Because you're not using a big weight to just fling it like you are with a spinning rod.
Correct. So just to contrast that, with a spinning rod, you've got an ounce to a 2 ounce lure or weight on the end of a monofilament line that is weightless. So that weight on the end of line is carrying that line through the air. In fly fishing, we've got a fly which is essentially weightless, and we're propelling that fly out in the same way with the weight of the line. So versus having a weight on the end of the line, that heavy lure propelling the line, we've got the line propelling this weightless fly. And it I mean, not to get too technical, but there's a lot of physics in how that all happens. And because that line is tapered, the physics will tell you that mass, if it's going through the air, and as you reduce that mass, it accelerates. And so that line or that loop then accelerates out to the end. And finally, then as it turns over and everything straightens out, and then that fly falls to the water.
Hmm. And there's this process of sort of back and forth. Mm-hmm. Is that when you're developing the loop, or what are you doing?
That's
when you're doing
when
that?
You're using the rod as a lever. So as you're going back and forth, you're putting a bend into the rod. And then what we do is we stop coming forward or back. The bend in the rod then unbends, and that transfers the energy to the line, which then makes that line does its magic through the taper of the line and the mass of the line, mm-hmm. to ultimately have the line unroll and straighten out and then fall to the water and deliver the fly.
So the finesse is a lot in the timing of when you how you flip the rod.
The timing, and also in the application and in the physical nature of what you do. You see a lot of people, and they want to just cast that fly rod with their wrist, kind of mm-hmm. moving in a big rainbow shape. And really, the more correct technique is to use your arm and have that rod move in a straight line, linear line, although it's bent, but it's moving in a straight line, not as much of a rainbow. And that's bending the rod and then stopping it and unbending it and transferring that energy to the line. I liken it to somewhat of a bow and arrow, right? You pull the string on the bow bends, it's got energy stored into it, you let go of the line, the bow unbends, transfers that energy to the end of the arrow and propels that forward. Mm-hmm. And a fly rod works in similar fashion. Mm-hmm. It's putting a bend in the fly rod through moving it forward, stopping it, the fly rod unbends, transfers the energy to the line, loop forms, and then the magic of the physics of the line itself take over.
Interesting. So I'm sure when you're watching a beginner, you can see all kinds of stuff that they may be doing wrong. As an instructor, you're helping them do it right. Once somebody gets so that they're good at it, do they keep getting good at it, or like once you've got it, you've got it?
Yeah, well, once you've got it, you've got it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can then continue and move on and continue to advance and take on advanced technique and more technical, if you will, type of cast that you try and do. But you know, it's like anything else. It's like riding a bike, right? I mean, we understand how to ride a bike, and we can mm-hmm. go from point A to point B on the bike, but then you want to get better and faster, right. And you know, take on other techniques in cycling. And you know, casting a fly rod and fly fishing is much the same. You can stay at a basic or an intermediate point, but you can certainly go to a much more advanced or refined point.
Mm-hmm. And it seems like it would be challenging on some of our creeks where you've got a lot of trees around the edge of the creek, because you need a little bit of motion there, right? So is that right. part of the advanced technique and figuring out how to do it where you don't get caught in the trees?
You know, I tell people fly fishing is all about problem solving. Uh-huh. And you're in an environment, much like you described, where you don't have any room behind you, and yet you've got to get that fly delivered to the fish in the water and the target. So we've got some casts, notably we call it the roll cast, where we don't aerialize that line behind us. We just put a loop of line behind us and then bend that fly rod, pulling against the loop of line behind us to propel it. Mm-hmm. So we've got, you know, from no room behind you to having to cast under trees. Maybe there's some bushes that are overhanging on the creek, and we want to get, you know, tuck a fly down under there where the fish might be. Uh-huh. And so, you know, I tell people it's like into solving problems.
Yeah.
That's again, a lot of the intrigue and the challenge of being on the river fly fishing.
There's a certain personality type, isn't there? You know, you can sort of figure who would be the guy who really would go and catch the biggest fish, get home, have a beer in front of the TV, and who would be the person who would want to sort of spend winter preparing, mm-hmm. get out there and be in a quiet spot and mm-hmm. and just finesse it and have an experience that really is not 100% about just hauling in the fish.
Just hauling in the fish. They talk about it, and I certainly experienced that in my life, where there's a transition. You know, you go from wanting to catch the most amount of fish, uh-huh. having the full basket of the full creel of the fish, to then wanting to catch the biggest fish, to then wanting to catch the most challenging fish. Mm-hmm. And that oftentimes is where fly fishers end up, is they're not there to catch the most amount of fish. They want to catch the most challenging fish. And it really is very, very satisfying. You know, it's challenging. You've got to figure out and solve problems in terms of what's the fly to use. You know, what is the fish eating and gonna be attractive mm-hmm. to them, to how to make that presentation to that fish of that fly so that it appears to be the most natural and much like the natural food that they're eating in the stream. And when you solve all of those pieces of the puzzle and you get that fly to, or that fish to eat your fly, that really is very, very satisfying.
Then there's a great sense of satisfaction and that you've done something that really counted. It did, not anybody could have done it.
Yeah. And if we'll talk with John about it, if you do that on a rod that you made, mm-hmm. or you do that on a fly that you tied,
yeah,
you know, that then takes it to a whole different level.
Yeah. So, and it seems to me that fly fishermen are much more also into the, a lot of times into the aesthetic of catch and release and just being in the place and not taking anything from it. Agreed?
Right. I certainly agree. I mean, I'm protecting the resource so that our kids and future generations have got an opportunity to experience the same thing we experienced mm-hmm. is a big part of my life in the sport.
Yeah. So tell me, what's the perfect day of fly fishing for you or even a real perfect day that took place? You don't have to give us your best fishing hole, but you can if you want to. And just like paint a picture for us.
Paint a picture. It would be out in western Alaska in one of the big rivers out there, the Naknek River, mm-hmm. With a two-hand rod or what we call a spey rod, which is another kind of higher level refined technique with a traditional line. Making, you know, long and beautiful cast. And it's not dry fly fishing. We're fishing those flies down under the surface. And so it's kind of feeling what that fly is doing in the water and getting the big grab of a big rainbow. Mm-hmm. The beautiful western Alaska rainbows that we get that get to be large sizes in the fall. And then landing that fish. And that's just as, you know, I might get one of those fish a day, maybe two of them a day, but that's really is a perfect day.
Yeah. So how do you land up, like those rainbows that they get in that part of the state can be salmon size.
I mean, they can be salmon size.
Yeah. I mean, how do you land something like that on a fly rod? I think of it as being such a delicate instrument.
Well, they are delicate instruments, and a fly rod that I'd use for a smaller grayling is much more delicate than a fly rod that I'd use for one of those larger rainbows mm-hmm. out in western Alaska. So we have various sized fly rods for various sized fish, mm-hmm. and we use a larger fly rod, typically an 8-weight fly rod for those larger fish, but they're a challenge. You know, it's like if you ever had a silver salmon on it, even a spinning rod, and trying to get them onto the bank, or if you go down to the Russian River this mm-hmm. time of year and see people trying mm-hmm. to land those sockeyes that they get, it's a challenge. And to do it,
patience,
because we're all catch and release, so you really don't want to just drag that beautiful rainbow up on the bank and have it mm-hmm. flopping around on the rocks where it'll injure itself. So you want to keep it in the water and mm-hmm. and preserve that fish as much as you can, so it's as healthy as it can be as you're releasing it.
How does the reel work when you're working a fish in? Because, you know, with a spinning reel, you're going to set the break so that it'll, it'll protect your mm-hmm. line, and that makes it easier. But with a fly rod, you really don't, you have a whole different setup, right?
Well, you've got a different setup, but it's much the same. We've got a break, or what mm-hmm. we call a drag on a reel. Mm-hmm. And so that provides some resistance for the line pulling out mm-hmm. that the fish is gonna pull against. Then it really, once you've hooked the fish, it's much the same.
Okay.
The fly rods bend just like your spinning rod bends, and you crank in and put the line back on the reel, and it's very similar.
It's Outdoor Explorer. We're talking about fly fishing today. I'm learning a lot. I always learn a lot on this show, but today especially. And it is really interesting, and I can really see the aesthetic appeal of fly fishing and the fact that you know, maybe when you're a kid, having everything be as easy as possible is the way you want it. But actually, when you grow up, sometimes you want things to be a little bit harder. And that's what these guys are all about. Mark Huber is my guest right now. He's with Alaska Fly Fishers and the International Federation of Fly Fishers. And he teaches casting. And you can find out about Alaska Fly Fishers website and Facebook on our website. Just go to alaskapublic.org. And click on today's show on fly fishing, and you'll get access to tons of information. Sounds like you guys are doing some events and activities that people sort of want to learn about fly fishing. It's one of those daunting things. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't want to just like walk into a sporting goods store and start buying stuff. You'd want to know something before you started. So tell us a little bit about Alaska Fly Fishers.
And that's where the Alaska Fly Fishers come in. As I oftentimes tell people, there's more knowledge of fly fishing in our monthly meetings than what you'll find, than I found anywhere else in Alaska. And a lot of what I learned about fly fishing in Alaska came from attending meetings and getting to know people in the Alaska Fly Fishers. You mentioned you've got to have some information on your website. If you search for Alaska Fly Fishers on Facebook, you'll find us there. If you also search Google, you'll find our website, which has got more information on the club. We meet on the first Monday of each month, except for the months of August and September, which are coming up, which we have events those months. So meeting the first Monday of each month, we have a presentation that we offer. We've got the events for those that are interested in learning how to tie flies. We have our fly tying group that meets on the third Saturday of each month at 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. at the Hernandez Fish Hatchery. The next meeting there will be on Saturday, July 18th. But then it'll be the third Saturday of each month, successive month. On August 22nd, which is a Saturday, we've got the Alaska Fly Fishing and Spayclave, and that will be at Mirror Lake, and that's going to be a full-day activity from 10 a.m. to 8 p.m. All about fly fishing. We'll have the fly tying group there. We'll be doing casting presentations. You have the ability to cast with experts and pros, pick up tips. We'll have manufacturers with equipment there to try for those people who are interested in getting into it. We've also in the afternoon going to have a casting contest with men's and women's and children division.
Is that seeing how far you can cast?
See how far you can cast, yes. Okay. Yes, that was a great hit last year.
Uh-huh.
And we provide the line, so it's everybody casts the same line. If you want to cast one of the rods that we have available, if you want to bring your own favorite mm-hmm. rod to cast that, certainly come out and do that. We'll have a barbecue then in the evening and with live music. And last year it was just a phenomenal event. We had about 100 people attend, and this year we're hoping that we'll have double that. Open to the public and no charge.
All right. And the date again?
It's August 22nd on Saturday at Mirror Lake Park. We've got one of our signature events is the Kenai River Cleanup, and that's where the club goes down and cleans up the Kenai River. We go from Kenai Lake down to Jim's Landing, and we include the highway and the pullouts and the Russian River.
Oh, good for you.
This will be the 20th, and I'm as I looked at that this morning, I'm not sure if it's 23rd or 24th year, but we're up into the mid-20s in years that we've successively have had this event. It'll be September 12th, which is a Saturday, and it's at the Russian River Ferry Launch down in Cooper Landing.
And you're just picking up garbage and, you know, fishing line and all that kind of
yes,
stuff.
Yes, yes. Okay. Well, and this great. Is a it ends up being for club members and certainly any member of the public that would like to. It's a two-day event. We do mm-hmm. the cleanup on Saturday. And we'll have over 100 volunteers picking up, as you mentioned, we get a lot of beer bottles mm-hmm. and monofilament line and just general trash there from the end of the season. We also find a few spare tires or two that come off on the highway there. And there's always, you know, something new and unique something weird. That's on Saturday. We have a barbecue then Saturday evening and a drawing for door prizes, which are overnight accommodations in the Cooper Landing area, as well as raft trips and guide trips on the river. Have live music that night. And then Sunday, for those people that want to stay over, then we fish on the river on the Upper Kenai on Sunday. So that's a wonderful event for the club and mm-hmm. club members and anybody who's got some interest in protecting that Upper Kenai and conserving that. And making it such the wonderful experience mm-hmm. that we all love about that part of the river.
Nice. Did you mention the event that you have coming up in July?
We've the fly tying group.
Okay, great.
That's what we've got Excellent. Coming up in July, and that's July 18th
got
at
it.
The Hernandez Fish Hatchery. And again, this information is all out on our Facebook page and
right.
the Fly Fishers
and
website.
Folks can find that through our site as well at alaskapublic.org on today's show. So you were mentioning the sort of different techniques and the different types of that there's different and there's a word that you used. For this two-handed rod.
Yes, spey.
Yeah, tell us about, spey like, when casting. Would you use those different techniques and what you know, and why you would use them?
Spey casting is an old European technique, and the two-hand, they'll call them two-hand rods. We call them in the U.S. more spey rods. But it was developed in the rivers of Scotland on the River Spey. Because, I don't know if you've seen European fishing, but they take it to a whole different level than we do. And they groom the banks of the river, mm-hmm. and they trim the trees, and they're in their ties and their jackets. And
right.
It's really quite an elegant affair.
Sportsman has a whole different meaning there.
It does. But this technique, because the trees and the vegetation grow right down to the riverbanks, they didn't have room behind them to throw an overhead cast and put that line far behind them. And so they came up with this two-hand rod in this technique, which is really a roll cast where they put a big loop of line behind them with much limited room and, mm-hmm. and much less room than an overhead cast, and then are able to make a fairly long cast out into the river. And that technique then has moved over into the western U.S. and western Canada over the last 30 years, and has within the last 15 years has come to Alaska.
And it sounds like a good practical alternative on our rivers, which also tend to have a lot of vegetation.
Yeah,
on the
a lot of vegetation. It's what got me into it was I saw in a video that Mel Krieger did, and he was demonstrating this, and he said, "Man, this is great for weighted flies and sink tip lines." And we do a lot of that fishing here in Alaska, where we fish down under the surface for these rainbows that are mm-hmm. hanging down there with the salmon, or fishing for salmon, and you've got to be deep in the river. And while I had done some of that with the single hand rod, kind of the old chuck and duck technique, I saw this technique and said, "Man, we no longer have to chuck and duck it anymore. We can, you know, get a longer lever and a bigger rod, and with this spey cast, and this basically mm-hmm. this roll cast, put that line out there without having to worry about it, you know, hitting us in the back
right.
or clobbering us."
Right. I could imagine that could be pretty embarrassing. So how many rods do you end up owning? Because, I mean, you can have, you were talking about, you know, a lighter rod for grayling, a heavier rod for rainbows, and the sort of a double-handed rod. I mean, I don't want to intimidate people, but yeah. It sounds like you could really need a lot of different gear for different types of situations.
Well, you do, and it's kind of similar to hunting. You know, if you're into hunting, which I'm not all that big into hunting, but if you're hunting small game, you've got a small mm-hmm. caliber rifle. If you're hunting a larger game, you get a larger caliber mm-hmm. rifle. And it's very similar in fly fishing. If you're fishing for grayling or smaller trout, you're going to have a smaller, maybe a 5 or 6 weight fly rod. If you're fishing for salmon, particularly king salmon, you're going to have a much larger fly rod. You're going to have more of a 10 weight fly rod. You and I were talking about bone fishing earlier. If you're going to go to saltwater is a whole different group of equipment. It's very similar, but it's all geared specifically towards saltwater.
Yeah.
And the species that you target in the saltwater. So it really depends on what you're targeting. I think as people get started here, they go with a medium size, typically a 7-weight fly rod, which kind of is a little bit too heavy for the smaller fish that they might do, and it's a little bit light for the larger fish that they might do. But something like the Upper Kenai or Willow Creek, Montana Creek, it's a perfect weight rod for.
And I'm guessing that when people come to you and they want to start fly fishing and take lessons, they're probably already fairly adept anglers, because the entryway into angling, at least in Alaska, is through spin casting. Is that true? I mean, you don't have to teach them how to fish, but you're teaching them how to fish a new way.
You teach them technique.
Yeah.
And that's for the most part. I mean, we get folks that just have never fished much before, and you know they've seen on programs or TV or mm-hmm. YouTube or whatnot fly fishing and become interested in it and want to come and get started. And so you work with them and get them started in the technique of it and also in fishing and reading the water and where the fish might be. But the majority of the folks that we get are coming from a fishing background, typically hardware or spin fishing, mm-hmm. and wanting to go to the next level. And
maybe they've already used flies on with weights or something.
Very possibly. Yeah. You know, I mean, we've been down on the Russian River, right, for the in a fly fishing only. And you know, the equipment that you see down there in many cases is anything but fly fishing. It's, you know, the definition there is having the fly on the end of the line that you've got.
Right. So with just a minute left, tell me how people can get in on your lessons or learn to do this.
You know, if they want to hook up with me for casting instruction, mm-hmm. I'm certainly available for that individual and smaller groups. They can reach me on my cell phone at 907-244-2779, or they can drop me an email at mhuber@gci.net.
All right, and probably
or through the Alaska Fly Fishers.
Probably through the Alaska Fly Fishers.
Yeah, come on out to one of our monthly meetings or one of our events that we spoke about.
All right. Well, thanks very much, Mark Huber, for being with us today. Really interesting.
It's been a pleasure.
Yeah. Stick with us in the second half. We're going to have Chris Carlin talking with us about making fly rods. Yes, there's a guy in Anchorage who makes his living building bamboo fly rods, and it's a really interesting fellow. I think you're going to enjoy it. So stay with us as Outdoor Explorer continues. For the past 7 years, a mosaic of organizations have run the Bristol Bay River and Guide Academy to train local kids the art of fly fishing. Dillingham reporter Matt Martin met up with this year's group at Kulik Lodge on the last day of the week-long academy.
Jet boats hydroplane up Kulik River and float planes skip across Lake Nonvionic as Kulik Lodge comes alive for a day of fishing. David Parks, Jr. of Iliamna, is one of 15 students at the Guide Academy. He stands in the crystal clear water of the Kulik with Sarah Pearl.
So could we possibly catch something right now?
Well, I'm trying to teach you how to cast first.
No, but I mean, that's what I mean. Can we possibly, like...
Yeah, if they're right there.
Oh, okay.
Pearl works as a housekeeper at the Kulik Lodge, but today she'll pretend to be a client so Parks can test the fly fishing and customer service skills he learned this week. Before this week, Parks had never fly fished. He'd always liked fishing, but grew up with only a typical rod and reel.
It was either that or ice fishing.
The first time he ever picked up a fly rod was the first day of class.
The next day we had to come out here and fish, and so I spent like half the time just swaying my rod back and forth, just trying to get that perfect swing.
Now, after just learning the skills himself, Park teaches Pearl, another novice, the finer points of casting with a fly rod.
As soon as you feel it tightened, is that better?
Yeah. There you go.
The students had a week-long crash course in fly fishing and what it takes to be a guide.
Like tying flies and making leaders and making sure we had all our customer service skills down.
Sonny Peterson is the owner of the Kulik Lodge. He currently doesn't have any Bristol Bay locals working for him, but he says they add a great value to the services that a lodge like his can provide.
People come up there and they ask where you're from, and your guide says he's from New York or Florida. You know, it doesn't sound as good as if he says I'm from Agiogic or Non-Dalton.
The Bristol Bay River and Guide Academy was founded in part by Tim Troll. He is also the head of the Bristol Bay Land Trust. Troll says the time is about right for locals to play a bigger role in the lodge industry.
It took 70 years in the commercial fishery before locals really broke into the commercial fishery, and now the lodge industry has been here about 70 years.
Troll used to be the president of Chogyung Limited in Dillingham. The native corporation owns a sport fishing lodge, and he says shareholders would often ask him why no locals worked in the lodge.
And I asked the operator that, and he said, well, I need guys who fly fish, and Bristol Bay wasn't producing any local fly fishermen. There were maybe a handful. So that sort of planted the idea in the back of my head is that if we are going to serve that industry, we have to produce somebody who can fly fish.
In 2008, Troll was finally able to see that idea come to life with the first Guide Academy. This is the seventh, and roughly 80 students have passed through the program, and four have been placed as permanent employees and a few other internships at sport lodges in the region. Troll says that even if most of the students don't get jobs at a lodge, they can learn about an industry that is all around them. He says many of these students may someday be leaders in their native corporations, which often own or lease land to lodges.
Just understanding the industry, how it works, how it operates, and also lodges from the other side, understanding what village corporations are all about, and trying to deal fairly with everybody and make it work.
He also says it's a way for kids to get exposure to people from all over the world.
Business leaders of the world come here. You get to mingle with these people. And who knows where that can take somebody.
Troll doesn't think the lodge industry will ever be a major employer in the region, but it could be a significant one. Sonny Peterson, owner of the Kulik Lodge, says a major hurdle to hiring local guides is that the work is only seasonal.
You know, a local kid here, it's tough for him because, you know, once this is over, that's it, you know. And unless they can figure out something to do the rest of the year.
David Parks, Jr. from Iliamna, echoes that concern.
It's hard to have just a seasonal job with, like, a box of Tide soap costing, like, $30, $40.
Parks will be starting a new job at the post office when he gets back to Iliamna, but he would love the chance to work at a lodge if he could.
I mean, if I had a job that would allow me to take like a month off during the summer, I'd do this job during the summers.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll work in a school.
There you go.
Work in the school in the winters, be a guide in the summer.
Whatever career path lies ahead for Parks, it's evident that this academy has left an impression on him. Reporting from Kulik Lodge, I'm Matt Martin.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on KSKA Anchorage. The program repeats tonight at 9 o'clock on FM 91.1. Connect with Outdoor Explorer anytime. Download podcasts and see what's coming up on future programs by going to our website at alaskapublic.org.
We're back. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Woolforth, and today we're talking about fly fishing, which, as often happens on our show, it's a topic I really don't know that much about. So my guests are being kind enough to walk me through it, and hopefully I'll be a good stand-in for you, the listener, to learn about fly fishing. But we're also going to get somewhat technical about gear, and for those of you who are really into the sport, because there's a lot of advanced stuff that's happening in Alaska, and my next guest is right in the middle of that. Chris Carlin has Far North Rod Smith, and he's building fly rods and selling them all over the world. Yeah, the sort of the high end market for rods. He's you know, creating them here in Anchorage, and that's just, I mean, I had no idea that was going on, but I think that's really cool.
Yeah, it's an unusual thing, and I focus on bamboo rod making, which is kind of a throwback. Fly rods were originally made of bamboo, probably for the last 100 years or so, until the technology moved into fiberglass in the early 70s and then into the current graphite stuff. So what I do is sort of a bit of a throwback to the classic days, but I also do a lot of modern technology stuff thrown in as well. So it's classic gear with the modern
twist. Well, that's really part of the aesthetic of the whole thing, isn't it? I mean, I'm just saying it's kind of like the original hipster thing, right?
Where
everything's got to be just exactly the artisan thing, and that's what fly fishing's all about. Is like the exact, just tuning it to the exact way you want it. Right?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it's sort of like anything. You kind of get something that enhances your experience. Mm-hmm. And anytime you can get a piece of equipment or, you know, a pair of shoes or a jacket or something that makes you enjoy something more, it's a good investment. Yeah. So it's the same idea.
And if you're not any good at it, never done it, you don't know the difference between a good fly rod and a bad one. But once you have made that a big part of your life, it probably makes a huge difference.
It really does, yeah. However, one of the nice things about bamboo is it's very user-friendly. So they're actually easier to learn because you can kind of feel what the rod's doing more than you can with a kind of a higher performance type graphite rod.
Yeah. So let's talk about like how you got from being the typical angler or wherever you were to being a person who's like, your career and your full-time job is making these rods and you're making a living at it. What's sort of the, how did you get introduced to fishing in the first place?
Well, when I was a kid, my mom was a big angler, so she was very much into fly fishing and got me into the sport in the Rockies. And when I moved up here to Alaska in the mid-90s, as many people, I had no money, but I wanted to get the best possible equipment I could, so I started to make rods. And when I say make, I mean buy a graphite blank, you know, turn down a cork grip myself, kind of glue all the components together.
Right. So you're already using some terminology. I don't know. So a blank is like just a piece of graphite.
Yeah. It's the rod proper. So okay. It's kind of the, you know, the main pole. And then the cork grip is the handle that you use.
Okay.
Reel seat is below the handle, and that's what your reel, which holds the line, is mounted to.
So then you're sort of assembling it.
Yeah, so you're really not making anything from scratch, but what it allows you to do is make a higher-end item for less money.
Got you.
So you're not paying, you know, the people at one of the high-end manufacturers to build it for you. So that allowed me to get into appreciating the better quality components and things.
And I don't want to, but it's a good time to ask this, I think, is where do you, I mean, you get to a certain level of skill in casting where you realize, oh, this rod's not good enough, or I want a better one, or how does that go? I mean,
it's a little bit more like more and more and more. It's probably a little bit analogous to golf, to where it's like, hey, I need a new iron or I need a new driver. And so you never really have to retire your old gear. You just have to get more of it.
You're lying awake at night thinking, I wonder what it would be like to have that. Right?
Exactly. Yeah.
I think it's the same. I mean, skiers know the same thing. Like you start on some rotten skis, you don't know they're not any good, and then you sort of try some better skis. Oh yeah, I want those.
You need your GS skis, your slalom skis, your all mountain skis, precisely the same sort of thing. So back to the story. After doing making a number of rods myself, I actually made a few for gifts, and of course Mom was one of the recipients. She ended up reciprocating that by getting me a book on how to make bamboo fly rods. And I'm sure it was kind of a self-serving hint type thing. But it was a nice gift. I set it aside, didn't give it much thought. And then got a little bit of extra disposable income from having a decent job and just started to put together the tools. Because mostly what you're using is typical woodworking type hand tools, you know, hand planes and things like that. And
Sounds like you're a pretty savvy guy with your hand anyway, so.
Yeah, I wasn't, but I found out I was after into it, yeah. And amassed all the tools, got everything together, and put my first rod together actually in an apartment, literally in my kitchen in the apartment to the chagrin of my girlfriend, and gave that one to my mom, and it turned out pretty nice. And so I kept making them. And through other contacts, internet contacts, friends, things like that, people eventually started to offer me money for them. And so I'd sell a few here, a few there. And it got to the point where I had a backlog of about 12 months of orders and realized that I could probably graduate into a full-time thing.
So I actually quit your day job.
Yeah. So I quit my day job and just went all in. And I've been doing that full-time for about the past 8 years or so.
That's amazing. Yeah. So when you go back and look at that first rod that you made for your mom, is it like, do you groan, or is it like actually pretty good?
It's not bad. You know, I see all the faults in it, and she sees all the positives. Mm-hmm. And she still does use it, so it does get out on the water occasionally. But far from my best effort.
So tell me, what is the hallmark of a really good fly rod?
Good quality craftsmanship, you know, straight, nice wraps, which the guides are the small metal pieces that the line goes through.
Okay.
And those are held on by a thread of some sort, silk or nylon. And so anytime you can get something that's just put together with care, that's, you know, clean, that's the craftsmanship part. But then there's also the flex of the rod, you know, the weight of the rod, as far as what type of line it casts, the length. So there's a lot of things that go into what makes a good rod, but good quality craftsmanship is probably the number one thing.
So do you need different rods for different weights of line?
Yeah, you do. You know, the way that fly fishing works is instead of using the weight of like a lure or a piece of lead to propel the fly, you're using the weight of the fly line. And so when you need to do really short casts or be very delicate, like when you're fishing for like a grayling or a small fish, you'll want a smaller, lighter, shorter rod. And when you want to fish for something larger, like a salmon or steelhead or something, or when you need to throw bigger flies, you know, subsurface flies, things like that, then yeah, you need a longer, heavier rod. So rods are made.
And that's because of how far you're flinging the fly out into the river, as opposed to how hard the fish is going to hit the rod, right?
Both. Okay. Yeah, yeah. I mean, you certainly want a bigger, heavier rod if you've got a steelhead hitting it versus a grayling hitting it. And there's also the fun factor. I mean, you can use a huge, heavy-duty tuna rod to catch a grayling, but it's not going to be much fun.
Point?
It's like
yeah.
using a broomstick, you know? Mm-hmm. So, yeah, you really want to kind of fine-tune your rod for what you're doing and catching.
Yeah, it seems like part of the aesthetic of fly fishing is... is not making it easy, right? I mean, it's about that sport and, you know, outdoor adventure and angling. It's really about the challenge, you know. And in Alaska, we have this continuum from the, you know, the commercial guys to the dip netters to the spin casters, and you're on the opposite end. Like, you're not meat fisherman. You're out there for the experience.
Yeah, you know, you like to throw the word art around a lot, you know, and in a way, it really is an art form in that, you know, you need to propel a little teeny tiny fly that weighs basically nothing 60, 70, or 80 feet across a river to a certain spot in order to, you know, fool a fish. And you get trees behind you and wind going, things like that. So you don't walk onto a river with a fly rod and are expert right off the bat.
Yeah.
So it takes a lot of time, a lot of effort. You know, there's different types of casts. There's different ways of fishing. So it really does kind of evolve from a sport into an art form once you get to the really, you know, spend a lot of time at it.
And now that you're making these rods as your occupation, you've kind of taken it to the absolute extreme, right? Because it's all about, I mean, the art is that built into that rod as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And you can fine tune exactly what you want to get out of a rod into it when you're building it from scratch. So
give me an example of what you mean.
Well, let's say if I wanted to go down to the Kenai and I want to fish for a trout, and I know I'm going to be making, say, 40 to 50 foot casts with a little bit of weight and maybe a large fly, I'll make a little heavier rod, a little bit longer for better, longer casting. I'll put a little more weight in the tip, so it's a little stronger tip. So it's still sensitive, so I can feel what the fish is doing or what the fly is doing off the bottom. But it also has enough to it to where, you know, there's enough backbone to when you hook into the fish, you know, you can fight it in a larger, faster current.
Mm-hmm. What happens if you by chance hook into like a king salmon or something? I mean, do you just like cut the line or what do you do?
Well, you can do a number of things. You can do what I call playing them off the reel, which is you
point the rod at the fish
and chase them around. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or you can, just cross your fingers, pray and see what happens. But a lot of times it's just they just run and break and you just laugh and put a new fly on.
Yeah. do these rods, they basically bend double. You don't have to worry about breaking the rod, right? Or do you?
Well, you do. I mean, you know, even a graphite rod or a fiberglass rod or anything, you know, even a tuna rod.
You can break anything.
You can break anything, yeah. So, you know, there is a certain amount of care, but there's a reason that bamboo is the material of choice for over 100 years. It's very strong. It's very resilient. You can bend it double. But as with anything, you know, you want to be as careful as you can be with it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And usually it's a car door or stepping on it that does the breakage rather than a fish.
And then you hear the scream.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't so much, but when you spend a bunch of money on it, then
Well, I'm sure these things aren't cheap, right?
Yeah. Yeah. The you know, a good graphite rod, store-bought, probably starts in the, you know, $50 to $100 range. But if you want something that performs really nice, you're probably talking $200, $300, $400 up to, you know, $700, $800 for a graphite rod. Bamboo rods start more in the thousand. Mm-hmm. So they're kind of $1,000, $1,500, $2,000. And then some of the really artsy ones that have, you know, hand engraves or ruby guides or something like that, they can be $5,000, $10,000.
Which presumably you're going to put on the wall of your den.
One would think, I mean, I would, if, you know, if I had a ruby guide on one of my rods, I wouldn't bring it down to the Kenai, that's for sure.
Yeah. So tell me about the process of building a rod. And I mean, what do you start with when you're building one of these bamboo rods?
Well, I actually use full culms of bamboo. And a culm is basically just the tree cut and into a 12-foot section. And it's a very specific kind of bamboo called Tonkin, which comes from one region in China.
Wow.
And a gentleman who is in Seattle, I think is currently the only importer of bamboo, but he actually goes over there every year, hand selects all the bamboo for all the bamboo rod makers in the U.S., which there's not a ton of them, but and then ships that back to Seattle. And then from there, he takes these 12-foot culms, bundles them into bundles of 10, and then he ships them up to me via barge. And I usually get about a year's worth, which is about 60 or 70 culms at a time.
And how much is that?
A culm of bamboo shipped door to door is probably about $40.
Right.
But there's kind of an economy of scale in there. You know, if you buy one, it's going to be more than that.
You're going to be multiplying the value of that quite a bit. But I mean, is it like a large mass of material that you're getting, or is it?
Hundreds of pounds, yeah,
okay.
Hundreds of pounds. Yeah, in fact, I have our whole driveway full right now because I just had a big bundle delivered last week.
Cool.
So I'm
and I wanted you to go on with that, but I forgot to tell people that it's Outdoor Explorer, and we're talking about fly fishing today. I got too into the conversation and didn't, like, reestablish who we are. I'm Charles Wolforth, and my guest today is Chris Carlin, who makes his living building bamboo fly rods here in town at Far North Rodsmith. And you can find his website on our website at alaskapublic.org. Just click on today's show on fly fishing. I'm sorry to interrupt you, Chris. We've only gotten into receiving the bamboo in the front door.
And that sounds difficult, but it's really just a phone call away.
Yeah.
But once I have the bamboo, you actually take it and split it down into little small sections. And then those kind of get sorted out for the good ones and the bad ones, and you have to do some spacing and things. And then each of those, most rods, bamboo rods, are made of six pieces. They're called hexagonal rods for obvious reasons, although there are quads, which are four-sided rods, and some other geometries. But the hexagonal rod is the most common one. So you end up taking six of these strips that are split and forming them into little equilateral triangles, and that's called roughing. And then you take each one of those strips.
What kind of
strips,
equipment do you use to do that with?
That's actually done with a power beveler, kind of a router with an angled bit on it.
Okay.
So you run it through and it makes just an even triangle.
Pretty specialized item, I think. Yeah.
The bit is, for sure.
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. And then from there, you actually start getting into the more difficult stuff where you're using hand planes and you're cutting tapers into the each one of those strips. So you actually have to take a strip and cut it down to, I always use thousands of an inch, but a tip of a typical bamboo rod will be about 70 thousandths of an inch. So you have to make each strip about 35 one-thousandths of an inch, which is about, it's about the tip of a pencil.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
So you're doing that. I mean, you're doing that, like, that's your day's work, is hand planing something down to that.
Correct.
Degree.
Yeah. Yeah. And,
wow.
And you have to do
so
six of them.
I can see why it costs $1,000.
Yeah. It's very labor intensive. And you have to do six strips, and they have to be identical within a thousandth or a two thousandths of an inch.
How do you even measure to that precision?
Good quality micrometers.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's really almost.
So for you wood butchers out there, this is like.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's a little more fine than
yeah.
that. Yeah, in fact, you know, it's like a German race car is like a thousandth of an inch, so it's similar to that. So anyway, then once you've got all your strips, your six strips finished and tapered, then those get rolled up and glued together. And that's what actually gives you the bamboo blank.
What kind of glue do you use?
I use a urea formaldehyde glue, similar to something you'd use for bow makers.
Okay.
But just a really high quality wood glue, usually something waterproof. Mm-hmm. I have used Tight Bond and some of the, just off the shelf glues, which works mm-hmm. okay.
Mm-hmm.
But you really want something fancy if you're charging a bunch of money for it.
Yeah. Does the glue affect the way the rod works?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You know, Tight Bond glue tends to stay a little bit flexible. Mm-hmm. So that means you're going to get a rod that is a little bit more flexible versus when you use Urac, which is the stuff that I use. Really crystallizes and makes it a little bit stiffer rod.
Mm, okay.
So yeah, certainly makes a difference. Then once you have the blank, whether you're making a graphite rod or a bamboo rod, the rest of it's about the same. You take cork rings, put those together, and then turn a grip. And when I say turn, it's, with a lathe.
Mm-hmm.
Then you take a reel seat, which is just usually a piece of wood and a couple metal bands, and that just holds the reel in place. Those get glued onto the butt section of the rod. And then you take your guides. There's usually 8 to 12 of them on a rod, and then those get carefully wrapped on using silk. And then you put some sort of finish on the threads. I use varnish. And then the entire rod, when you're doing bamboo, actually gets finished afterwards. So the entire process, it's about a 2-week-long process when you figure in drying time and all the other stuff.
Right.
But it takes about 30 to 40 hours of hands-on labor to do one rod.
Wow. So is the character of the rod known to you before you start, or does it start to develop as you go along through the process?
You pretty much have to know basically what you're doing when you start it, because you're cutting things to length and you're mm-hmm. splitting a certain size. So right off the bat, you need to know roughly what you're doing. And then once you get to the point where you're planing those six strips down to their final dimensions, you have to know exactly what you want. And then once those are planed, that's what your rod's going to be. And the character of the rod is built into the graduations of the rod.
How did you, develop just sort of an intuition about how those interact, or the dimensions and the planing to the final product at the end? Or is there something that you can, a cookbook that you use for that?
A little bit of both. There are what are called tapers, which, the famous rod makers of the past would make rods, and then people would mic them or measure them mm-hmm. and then put those on paper. So that's usually a good starting point, is you mm-hmm. can say, hey, I want to take a Payne 204, which is a specific rod, and I want to mimic that. So you can pull those numbers. And if you don't want to use someone else's tapers, then you have to make one yourself. And that can be anything from a straight taper, which is just, it gets wider at the butt and narrower toward the tip, to things with lots of curves and flexes and things. And there's computer programs out there. I've written computer programs. There's intuition. Some people have done, slide rule comparisons. So there's a lot of different ways to take a rod and adapt it and try and create what you're looking for. But in the end, you've got to get the rod, make it, cast it, and then kind of fix things from there.
And you're a fisherman, and so you know what you want, you know what feels right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but I mean, at some point you must have hit the sweet spot, because you started getting all these orders, and so there's something that you're doing that's special, because you're here in Anchorage, Alaska, making your living, and people all over the world are buying these rods.
Yeah, and I hate to say it, but a lot of it's just making them look pretty, because that's how they sell online. What you end up doing is you kind of end up breaking down into 3 or 4 or 5 lines of rods. So it would be, like a whole range of line weights for, rods from grayling all the way up through salmon, but they all have similar character, similar feel. And once you describe to someone, as best you can on the phone, how a rod casts, and kind of evaluate their casting stroke and what they're trying to do, you can make a recommendation of a certain type of flex or a certain length or something like that. And most people fit into one of those kind of lines of rods, you know, that they like that feel, so they'll stick with that kind of that whole progression.
So it sounds like your personality is a big part of this business too.
Oh, absolutely.
Because you have to be able to talk fishing in a way that really engages with those
absolutely
guys.
Yeah, and other people's personalities as well, because everybody has, you know, their own casting stroke, they have their own fishing situations. So yeah, it's a lot of getting to know someone before you just, you know, take their money and send them a stick.
Yeah. So how do most of your customers find out about you? I mean, you're not just Googling, "I want a fly rod," but before you spend this kind of money on something that's super personal.
I would say most of it is word of mouth. Mm-hmm. You know, you sell one to a person and he tells his buddy, or they're on the creek together and he says, "Hey, try this rod." And so most of them come that way. Although there are a fair number of people that just go on Google, put in bamboo fly rods, and, you know, they look at your website, they like your pictures, and they'll, you know, give you an email or give you a phone call, and there's your order.
And where are these orders coming from?
All over the world. All over the world. I have two that are going to South Africa, or went out yesterday to South Africa. I have one I'm working for, a gentleman in Australia, supposed to be next month. Another gentleman in Argentina. A couple guys in the States are actually coming up here to Alaska to pick theirs up and then go out and go fishing.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So, yeah, all over the place. And that's one of the real treats, is I get to, you know, meet and talk to people just all over the world. And maybe one day go and visit them all, but not yet.
Yeah. I mean, you're in your shop building rods. Do you ever get to go fishing anymore?
Yeah. As much as I can. I spend probably as much time out on the front road test casting rods as I do actually on the water. But I do have a cabin up north that we'd get to as much as we can. And then, you know, annual trips to steelhead and saltwater and stuff like that.
Yeah. So what's your favorite kind of fishing? I mean, what's a perfect fishing day for you?
You know, up here, I think a nice day on a steelhead stream where it's
like
overcast.
Like Anchor River or somewhere like
that. Yeah,
yeah,
or the Sea Tuck or something, mm-hmm. is probably my favorite, just because you're out there. Although, you know, being from Colorado, I really miss high country, fast-moving creeks, fishing for little bitty, you know, brook trout and things like that. Uh-huh. So I have I'll always have an affinity for that.
Yeah. So, you know, it takes you, it sounds like a work week to make one rod.
Yeah.
And I don't want to say anything that's sacrilege here, but what about getting some people to come and help you and do some of this work, right?
It'd be great if I didn't have to pay them.
Yeah,
yeah, there's actually a fair amount of what I would call grunt work, or mm-hmm. something where you could hire someone at minimum wage to come in and give you a hand. But, you know, I think one of the mystiques is when you buy something like that, or like a fancy piece of furniture, mm-hmm. is you're getting it made by one guy, you know, yeah. So that they're imagining me up there.
It's like buying your samurai sword.
Exactly. Yeah. So you have, you know, one guy, and they imagine him in his little wood shop in the cold, you know, etching away at the guide or whatever. So I think that's part of the mystique to it. So, you know, maybe someday if I ever get to the point where I really need to crank out some volume, I might do that. But for now, it's just me.
You know, hire a workshop in China.
There you go.
Put your stamp on it.
Right.
That's for your retirement plan.
Sure.
Yeah. No, that would truly be sacrilege, right?
It absolutely would be. Yeah. In fact, I got an email from a company in China that was trying to sell me blanks.
Oh, wow.
I don't know how they do it, but I'm sure they're not as pretty as mine.
Right. Well, I'm sure there's somebody out there who's pocketing the money, but it sounds like you're doing it the honest way, which is really the whole heart of the sport, which is sort of doing it the honest, old-fashioned way without shortcuts.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and even if you don't do your own rods, you can do stuff like tying your own flies, or, you know, there's a lot to it that makes it personal to you.
Yeah, really neat. Well, thanks so much for coming in, Chris. This has really been really fun. I've learned so much.
Well, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah. This has been Chris Carlin, who has Far North Rodsmiths and builds rods here in Anchorage, and you can get to his website through ours at alaskapublic.org if you want to buy a rod, or you could probably just call him up too.
Sure, we'll just talk.
Yeah, all right. Well, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Please join us again next week at the same time for another edition of Outdoor Explorer. You can always find out what we've got coming up on the show by checking our website. Go to alaskapublic.org and click on the Outdoor Explorer icon. Many thanks to our producer, Monica Goki, and to Grace Bojean, who books many of our guests. I'm Charles Wolforth. I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal the Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and on iTunes. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.